that we had said no frogs in the house.
No,
Oliver said, with vehement nodding from Amanda.
You said no toads.
No amphibians of any kind, Philip ground out.
But what if one of them is dying?
Amanda asked, her pretty blue eyes filling with tears. Not even then.
But
you may tend to it outside.
What if it's cold and freezing and only needs my care and a warm bed inside the house?
Frogs are supposed to be cold and freezing, Philip shot back. It's why they are amphibians.
But what if...
No, he bellowed. No frogs, toads, crickets, grasshoppers, or animals of any kind in the house. Amanda started gulping for air.
But...
Philip let out a long sigh. He never knew what to say to his children, and now his daughter looked as if she might dissolve into a pool of tears. For the love of... He caught himself just in time and softened his voice. What is it, Amanda? She gasped, then sobbed.
What about Bessie?
Philip felt around, unsuccessfully, for a wall to sag against. Naturally, he ground out. I did not intend to include our beloved spaniel in that statement.
Well, I wish you'd said so,
Amanda sniffed, looking surprisingly and suspiciously recovered.
You made me extremely sad.
Philip gritted his teeth. I am sorry I made you feel sad. She nodded at him like a queen. Philip groaned. When had the twins gained the upper hand in the conversation? Surely a man of his size, and he'd like to think, anyway, intellect, ought to be able to manage 2 8-year-olds. But no. Once again, despite his best intentions, he'd lost all control of the conversation, and now he was actually apologising to them. Nothing made him feel more like a failure. Right, then, he said, eager to be done. Run along, I'm very busy. They stood there for a moment, just looking up at him with wide, blinking eyes.
All day?
Oliver finally asked. All day? Philip echoed. What the devil was he talking about?
Are you going to be busy all day?
Oliver amended. Yes, he said sharply. I am.
What if we went on a nature walk?
Amanda suggested. I can't, he said, even though part of him wanted to. But the twins were so vexing, and they were sure to force him to lose his temper, and nothing terrified him more.
We could help you in the greenhouse,
Oliver said. Destroy it was more like it. No, Philip said. He honestly didn't think he could answer to his temper if they ruined his work.
But
I can't, he snapped, hating the tone of his voice.
But, and who is this?
Came a voice from behind him. He turned around. It was Eloise Bridgerton, sticking her nose into what was assuredly not her business. And this after arriving on his doorstep without even so much as a hint of warning. I beg your pardon, he said to her, not bothering to hide the irritation in his voice. She ignored him and faced the twins.
And who might you be?
She asked.
Who are you?
Oliver demanded. Amanda's eyes narrowed into slits. Philip allowed himself his first true grin of the morning and crossed his arms. Yes, let's see how Miss Bridgerton handled this.
I am Miss Bridgerton, she said. You're not our new governess, are you?
Oliver asked, with suspicion bordering on venom.
Heavens no, she replied. What happened to your last governess?
Philip coughed, loudly. The twins took the hint.
Nothing,
Oliver said. Miss Bridgerton didn't look the least bit fooled by the air of innocence the twins were trying to convey, but she wisely did not choose to pursue the subject, and instead just said,
I am your guest.
The twins pondered that for a moment, and then Amanda said,
We don't want any guests,
followed by Oliver's,
We don't need any guests.
Children, Philip interjected, not really wanting to take Miss Bridgerton's side after she'd been so meddlesome, but really having no other choice. He couldn't let his children be so rude. The twins crossed their arms in unison and gave Miss Bridgerton the cut direct. "That's it!" Philip boomed. "You will apologise to Miss Bridgerton at once." They stared at her mutinously. "No!" he roared.
"Sorry," they mumbled,
but no one could ever have mistaken them for meaning it. "Back to your room, the both of you," Philip said sharply. They marched off like a pair of proud soldiers, noses in the air. It would have been quite an impressive sight if Amanda hadn't turned around at the bottom of the stairs and stuck out her tongue.
"Amanda!"
he bellowed, striding toward her. She tore up the stairs with the speed of a fox. Philip held himself very still for several moments, his hands fisted and shaking at his sides. Just once, once, he would like his children to behave and mind, and not answer a question with a question, and be polite to guests and not stick out their tongues, and just once he'd like to feel that he was a good father, that he knew what he was doing, and not raise his voice. He hated when he raised his voice, hated the flash of terror he thought he saw in their eyes, hated the memories it brought back for him.
"Sir Philip?"
Miss Bridgerton. Damn, he'd almost forgotten she was there. He turned around. "Yes?" he asked, mortified that she'd witnessed his humiliation, which, of course, made him irritated with her.
"Your butler brought the tea tray,"
she said, motioning to the drawing room. He gave her a curt nod. He needed to get outside, away from his children, away from the woman who'd seen what a terrible father he was to them. It had started to rain, but he didn't care.
"I hope you enjoy your breakfast," he said. "I will see you after you have rested."
And then he made haste out the door, making his way to his greenhouse, where he could be alone with his non-speaking, non-misbehaving, non-meddlesome plants.
Chapter 3.
You will see why I could not accept his suit. He was too churlish by half, and positively possessed of a foul temper. I should like to marry someone gracious and considerate, who treats me like a queen, or at the very least a princess. Surely that is not too much to ask.
From Eloise Bridgerton to her dear friend Penelope Featherington, sent by messenger after Eloise received her first proposal of marriage. By afternoon, Eloise was almost convinced that she had made a terrible mistake, and in truth, the sole reason she was only almost convinced was that the only thing she hated more than making mistakes was the admission thereof. So she was trying to maintain a proverbial stiff upper lip and forcing herself to pretend that this ghastly situation might all work itself out in the end. She had been left stunned, open-mouthed even, when Sir Philip had departed with barely more than an "enjoy your food" and then stalked out the door. She had travelled halfway across England, answering his invitation to come and visit, and he left her alone in the drawing-room a mere half-hour after she arrived. She hadn't expected him to fall in love at first sight and drop to his knees, professing his undying devotion, but she'd hoped for a little bit more than a curt "Who are you?" and "Enjoy your food." Or maybe she had expected him to fall in love at the first sight of her. She'd built an elaborate dream around her image of this man, an image which she now knew to be untrue. She'd let herself mould him into the perfect man, and it hurt so much to learn that he wasn't just imperfect, he was quite close to abysmal. And the worst was, she had only herself to blame. Sir Philip had never misrepresented himself in his letters, although she did think he ought to have mentioned that he was a father, especially before he'd proposed marriage. Her dreams had been just that. Dreams. Wishful illusions. All of her own making.
If he wasn't what she'd expected, that was her fault. She'd been expecting something that didn't even exist, and she should have known better. What's more, he didn't seem to be a very good father, which was as black a mark as anyone could get in her book. No, she wasn't being fair. She shouldn't judge him so quickly on that score. The children didn't look ill-treated or malnourished or anything so dire, but Sir Philip clearly had no idea how to manage them. He had handled them all wrong this morning, and it was clear, from the way they behaved, that his relationship with them was distant at best. Good heavens, they had practically begged him to spend the day with them. Any child who actually received enough attention from his parents would never act in such a way. Eloise and her siblings had spent half their childhood trying to avoid their parents, lack of supervision being, of course, more conducive for mischief. Her own father had been splendid. She had been only 7 when he'd died, but she remembered him well, from the stories he wove at bedtime to the hikes they had taken across the fields of Kent, sometimes with all the Bridgertons in tow, sometimes just with one lucky child, chosen for some special alone time with father. It was clear to her that if she hadn't suggested to Sir Philip that he find out why his children were screaming and knocking over the furniture, he would have left them to their own devices, or, more to the point, left them to be someone else's problem. And by the end of their conversation, it was apparent that Sir Philip's main aim in life was to avoid his children, which Eloise did not approve of at all. She pushed herself off of her bed, forcing herself upright, even though she was bone-tired. But every time she laid down, something began to quicken in her lungs, and she felt herself gasping in that awful precursor to not just tears, but true body-shaking sobs. If she didn't get up and do something, she wasn't going to be able to control herself. And she didn't think she could bear herself if she cried. She wrenched the window open, even though it was still grey and drizzling outside. There was no wind, so the rain ought not to blow in, and what she really needed right now was a bit of fresh air. A slap of cold on her face might not make her feel better, but it certainly wasn't going to make her feel worse. From her window, she could see Sir Philip's greenhouse. She assumed that was where he was, since she hadn't heard him here in the house, stomping about and bellowing at his children. The glass was fogged up, and the only thing she could see was a blurry curtain of green. His beloved plants, she supposed. What sort of man was he, that he preferred plants to people? Certainly not anyone who appreciated a fine conversation. She felt her shoulders sag. Eloise had spent half her life in search of a fine conversation. And if he was such a hermit, why had he bothered to write her back? He had worked just as hard as she had to perpetuate their correspondence, not to mention his proposal. If he hadn't wanted company, he had no business inviting her here. She took a few deep breaths of the misty air and then forced herself to stand up straight. She wasn't certain what she was expected to do with herself all day. She'd taken a nap already. Exhaustion had quickly won out over misery. But no one had come by to inform her of lunch, or of any other plans that might extend to her as a houseguest. If she stayed here, in this slightly drab and draughty room, she was going to go mad, or at the very least cry herself into oblivion, which was something she did not tolerate in others. So the thought of doing it herself was horrifying. There was no reason she couldn't explore the house a bit, was there? And maybe she could find herself some food along the way. She'd eaten all 4 muffins on the tea tray this morning, all with as much butter and marmalade as she could politely slather on, but she was still famished. At this point, she thought she might be willing to commit violence for a ham sandwich. She changed her clothing, donning a dress of peach muslin that was pretty and feminine without being too frilly. And, most importantly, it was easy to get on and off. Surely a critical factor when one had run from home without a lady's maid. A quick glance in the mirror told her that she looked presentable, if no picture of ravishing beauty, and so she stepped out into the hall, only to be immediately confronted by the 8-year-old Crane twins, looking very much as if they'd been lying in wait for hours.
"Good afternoon," Eloise said, waiting for them to come to their feet. "How nice of you to greet me." "We're not here to greet you," Amanda blurted out, grunting when Oliver elbowed her in the ribs. "You're not?" Eloise asked, trying to sound surprised. "Are you here, then, to show me to the dining room? I'm quite hungry, I must say."
"No,"
Oliver said, crossing his arms. "Not even that," Eloise mused.
"Let me guess. You're here to take me to your room and show me your toys."
"No,"
they said in unison.
"Then it must be to take me on a tour of the house. It's quite large and I might lose my way."
"No."
"No?
You wouldn't want me to lose my way, would you?"
"No,"
Amanda said.
"I mean, yes."
Eloise feigned incomprehension.
"You want me to lose my way?"
Amanda nodded. Oliver just tightened his arms across his chest and speared her with a sullen stare.
"Hmm, that's interesting. But it hardly explains your presence right here outside my door, does it? I'm not likely to get lost in the company of you two."
Their lips parted in befuddled surprise.
"You do know your way around the house, don't you?"
"Of course,"
Oliver grunted, followed by Amanda's,
"We're not babies."
"No, I can see that,"
Eloise said with a thoughtful nod.
"Babies wouldn't be allowed to wait by themselves outside my door after all. They'd be quite busy with nappies and bottles and the like."
They had nothing to add to that.
"Does your father know you're here?"
"He's busy. Very busy."
"He's a very busy man.
Much too busy for you."
Eloise watched and listened with interest as the twins shot off their lightning-fast statements, falling all over themselves to demonstrate how busy Sir Philip was.
"So what you're telling me," Eloise said, "is that your father is busy."
They stared at her, momentarily dumbfounded by her calm retelling of the facts, then nodded.
"But that still doesn't explain your presence,"
Eloise mused.
"Because I don't think your father sent you here in his stead."
She waited until they shook their heads in the negative, then added,
"Unless..." "I know,"
she said in an excited voice, allowing herself a mental smile over her cleverness. She had 9 nephews and nieces. She knew exactly how to talk to children.
"You're here to tell me you have magical powers and can predict the weather."
"No,"
they said, but Eloise heard a giggle.
"No? That's a shame, because this constant drizzle is miserable, don't you think?"
"No,"
Amanda said quite forcefully.
"Father likes the rain, and so do we."
"He likes the rain?"
Eloise asked in surprise.
"How very odd."
"No, it's not,"
Oliver replied, his stance defensive.
"My father isn't odd. He's perfect. Don't say mean things about him."
"I didn't,"
Eloise replied, wondering what on earth was going on now. At first she'd merely thought the twins were here to frighten her away. Presumably, they had heard that their father was thinking of marrying her and wanted no part of a stepmother, especially given the stories Eloise had been told by the housemaid of the succession of poor, abused governesses who had come and gone. But if that were the simple truth, wouldn't they want her to think there was something wrong with Sir Philip? If they wanted her gone, wouldn't they be trying to convince her that he would be a terrible candidate for marriage?
"I assure you, I harbour no ill will toward any of you," Eloise said. "In fact, I barely know your father."
"If you make father sad, I will...
Eloise watched the poor little boy's face grow red with frustration as he fought for words and bravado. Carefully, gently, she crouched next to him until her face was on a level with his, and said,
"Oliver, I promise you, I am not here to make your father sad."
He said nothing, so she turned to his twin and asked,
"Amanda?"
"You need to go!"
Amanda blurted out, her arms crossed so tightly that her face was turning red.
"We don't want you here."
"Well, I'm not going anywhere for at least a week," Eloise told them, keeping her voice firm.
The children needed sympathy, and probably a great deal of love as well, but they also needed a bit of discipline and a clear idea of who was in charge. And then, out of nowhere, Oliver hurled himself forward and pushed her hard, with both hands against her chest. Her balance was precarious, crouching as she was on the balls of her feet. Eloise toppled over backward, landing most inelegantly on her bottom and rolling back until she was quite certain the twins had received a nice look at her petticoats.
"Well,"
she declared, rising to her feet and crossing her arms as she stared sternly down at them. They had both taken several steps back and were staring at her with a mixture of glee and horror, as if they couldn't quite believe that one of them had had the nerve to push her over.
"That,"
Eloise continued, "was inadvisable."
"Are you going to hit us?"
Oliver asked. His voice was defiant, but there was a hint of fright there, as if someone had hit them before.
"Of course not," Eloise said quickly. "I don't believe in striking children. I don't believe in striking anyone."
"Except people who strike children," she added to herself. They looked somewhat relieved to hear it.
"I might remind you, however," Eloise continued, "that you struck me first."
"I pushed you,"
he corrected. She allowed herself a tiny groan. She ought to have anticipated that one.
"If you do not want people striking you, you ought to practice the same philosophy."
"The golden rule,"
Amanda piped up.
"Exactly,"
Eloise said with a wide smile. She rather doubted she'd changed the course of their lives with one little lesson, but nonetheless it was nice to hope that something she'd said provoked some consideration.
"But doesn't that mean,"
Amanda said thoughtfully, "that you should go home?"
Eloise felt her small moment of elation crumbling to dust as she tried to imagine what leap of logic Amanda was about to embark upon to explain why Eloise should be banished to the Amazon.
"We're home,"
Amanda said, sounding exceedingly supercilious for an 8-year-old. Or maybe she was supercilious, as only an 8-year-old could be.
"So you should go home."
"It doesn't work that way," Eloise said sharply.
"Yes, it does,"
Amanda replied with a smug little nod.
"Do unto others as you would like done to you. We haven't gone to your house, so you shouldn't come to ours."
"You're very clever. Did you know that?"
Eloise asked. Amanda looked as if she wanted to nod, but she was clearly too suspicious of Eloise's compliment to accept it. Eloise bent down so that they were face to face, all three of them.
"But I,"
she said to them in a very serious and slightly defiant voice,
"am very clever too."
They stared at her with wide eyes, their mouths hanging slack, as they regarded this person who was clearly so different from any other adult they'd ever met.
"Do we understand each other?"
Eloise asked, straightening her spine and smoothing her hands along her skirts in a deceptively casual manner. They said nothing, so she decided to answer for them.
"Good,"
she said.
"Now then, would you like to show me where the dining room is? I'm famished."
"We have lessons,"
Oliver said.
"You do?"
Eloise asked, arching her brows.
"How interesting. Then you must return to them at once. I imagine you've fallen behind after spending so long waiting outside my door."
"How did you know?"
Amanda's question was cut short by Oliver's elbow in her ribs. "I have 7 brothers and sisters," Eloise answered, deciding that Amanda's question deserved an answer, even if her brother hadn't allowed her to finish her sentence. "There isn't much about this sort of warfare that I don't already know." But as the twins scurried down the hall, Eloise was left chewing her lower lip in apprehension. She had a feeling she shouldn't have ended their encounter with such a challenge. She had practically dared Oliver and Amanda to find a way to evict her from the premises. And while she was quite certain they wouldn't succeed, she was a Bridgerton after all, and made of sterner stuff than those two even knew existed. She had a feeling that they would throw every fibre of their being into the task. Eloise shuddered. Eels in the bed, hair dipped in ink, jam on chairs. It had all been done to her at one point or another, and she didn't particularly relish a repeat performance, and certainly not by a pair of children 20 years her junior. She sighed, wondering what it was she had gotten herself into. She had better find Sir Philip and get to the task of deciding whether they would suit, because if she really was leaving in a week or two, never to see any of the Cranes again, she wasn't sure that she wanted to put herself through the trouble of mice and spiders and salt in the sugar bowl. Her stomach rumbled. Whether it was the thought of salt or sugar that did it, Eloise didn't know, but it was definitely time to find something to eat, and better sooner than later, before the twins had a chance to figure out how to poison her food. Philip knew that he'd blundered badly, but deuce it, the bloody woman had given him no warning. If she'd only alerted him of her arrival, he could have prepared himself, thought of a few poetic things to say. Did she really think he'd scribbled all those letters without labouring over every word? He'd never sent out the first draft of any of his missives, although he always wrote it on his best paper, each time hoping that this would be the time he'd get it right on the first try. Hell, if she'd given him warning, he might have even summoned a romantic gesture or two. Flowers would have been nice, and heaven knew, if there was one thing he was good at, it was flowers. But instead, she'd simply appeared before him as if conjured from a dream, and he'd mucked everything up. And it hadn't helped that Miss Eloise Bridgerton was not what he had expected. She was a 28-year-old spinster, for heaven's sake. She was supposed to be unattractive, horse-faced even. Instead, she was, well, he wasn't exactly certain how one could describe her. Not beautiful, precisely, but still somehow stunning, with thick chestnut hair and eyes of the clearest, crispest grey. She was the sort of woman whose expressions made her beautiful. There was intelligence in her eyes, curiosity in the way she cocked her head to the side. Her features were unique, almost exotic, with her heart-shaped face and wide smile. Not that he'd seen much of that smile. His less-than-legendary charm had seen to that. He jammed his hands into a pile of moist soil and scooped some into a small clay pot, leaving it loosely packed for optimal root growth. What the devil was he going to do now? He'd pinned his hopes on his mirage of Miss Eloise Bridgerton, based upon the letters she'd sent to him over the past year. He didn't have time, nor, in truth, the inclination, to court a prospective mother for the twins, so it had seemed perfect, not to mention almost easy, to woo her through letters. Surely an unmarried woman, rapidly approaching the age of 30, would be gratified to receive a proposal of marriage. He hadn't expected her to accept his offer without meeting with him, of course, and he wasn't prepared to formally commit to the idea without making her acquaintance either. But he had expected that she would be someone who was at least a little bit desperate for a husband. Instead, she'd arrived looking young and pretty and smart and self-confident. And good God, but why would a woman like that want to marry someone she didn't even know? Not to mention tie herself to a decidedly rural estate in the farthest corner of Gloucestershire. Philip might know less than nothing about fashion, but even he could tell that her garments had been well made, and most probably of the latest style. She was going to expect trips to London, an active social life, friends, none of which she was likely to find here at Romney Hall. It seemed almost useless to even try to make her acquaintance. She wasn't going to stay, and he'd be foolish to get his hopes up. He groaned, then cursed for good measure. Now he was going to have to court some other woman. Curse it! Now he was going to have to find some other woman to court, which was going to be nearly as difficult. No one in the district would even look at him. All of the unmarried ladies knew about the twins, and there wasn't a one of them willing to take on the responsibility of his little devils. He'd pinned all of his hopes on Miss Bridgerton, and now it seemed that he was going to have to give up on her as well. He set his pot down too hard on a shelf, wincing as the clatter of it rang through the greenhouse. With a loud sigh, he dunked his muddy hands into a bucket of already dirtied water to wash them off. He'd been rude this morning. He was still rather irritated that she'd come out here and wasted his time. Or if she hadn't wasted it yet, she was almost certainly going to waste it, since she wasn't likely to turn around and leave this evening. But that didn't excuse his behaviour. It wasn't her fault he couldn't manage his own children, and it certainly wasn't her fault that this failing always put him in a foul mood. Wiping his hands on a towel he kept by the door, he strode out into the drizzle and made his way to the house. It was probably time for luncheon, and it wouldn't hurt anyone to sit down with her at the table and make polite conversation. Plus, she was here. After all his effort with the letters, it seemed foolish not to at least see if they might get on well enough for marriage. Only an idiot would send her packing, or allow her to leave, without even ascertaining her suitability. It was unlikely that she would stay, but not, he reckoned, impossible, and he might at least give it a try. He made his way through the misty drizzle and into the house, wiping his feet on the mat that the housekeeper always left out for him, near the side entrance. He was a mess, as he always was after working in the greenhouse, and the servants were used to him in such a state, but he supposed he ought to clean up before finding Miss Bridgerton and inviting her to eat with him. She was from London, and would surely object to sitting at table with a man who was less than perfectly groomed. He cut through the kitchen, nodding genially at a maid washing carrots in a tub of water. The servant stairs were just outside the other kitchen door, and "Miss Bridgerton," he said in surprise. She was sitting at a table in the kitchen, halfway through a very large ham sandwich, and looking remarkably at home on her perch on a stool. "What are you doing here?"
"Sir Philip," she said, nodding at him.
"You don't have to eat in the kitchen," he said, scowling at her, for no reason other than that she was not where he'd expected her to be. That, and the fact that he'd actually intended to change his clothes for lunch, something with which he did not ordinarily bother, for her benefit. And here she'd caught him a mess anyway.
"I know," she replied, cocking her head and blinking those devastating grey eyes at him. "But I was looking for food and company, and this seemed the best place to find both."
Was that an insult? He couldn't be certain, and her eyes looked innocent. So he decided to ignore it and said, "I was just on my way to change into cleaner attire and invite you to share my lunch with me."
"I would be happy to remove myself to the breakfast room and finish my sandwich there, if you wish to join me,"
Eloise said.
"I'm sure Mrs. Smith wouldn't mind making another sandwich for you. This one is delicious."
She looked over at the cook.
"Mrs. Smith?"
"It's no trouble at all, Miss Bridgerton,"
the cook said, leaving Philip nearly gaping at her. It was quite the friendliest tone of voice he had ever heard emerge from her lips. Eloise edged herself off of her stool and picked up her plate.
"Shall we?"
she said to Philip.
"I have no objection to your attire."
Before he even realised that he had not agreed to her plan, Philip found himself in the breakfast room. Seated across from her at the small round table he used far more often than the long, lonely one in the formal dining room. A maid had carried Miss Bridgerton's tea service, and after inquiring if he wanted some, Miss Bridgerton herself had expertly prepared him a cup. It was an unsettling feeling, this. She had manoeuvred him quite neatly to serve her purposes, and somehow it didn't quite matter that he'd intended to ask her to lunch with him in this very manner. He liked to think he was at least nominally in charge in his own home.
"I met your children earlier,"
Miss Bridgerton said, lifting her teacup to her lips. "Yes, I was there," he replied, pleased that she had initiated the conversation. Now he didn't have to.
"No,"
she corrected.
"After that."
He looked up in question.
"They were waiting for me," she explained, "outside my bedchamber door."
An awful feeling began to churn and roll in his stomach. Waiting for her with what? A bag of live frogs? A bag of dead frogs? His children had not been kind to their governesses, and he did not imagine they'd be much more charitable to a female guest who was obviously there in the role of prospective stepmother. He coughed.
"I trust you survived the encounter."
"Oh, yes," she said. "We have reached an understanding of sorts."
"An understanding?"
He eyed her warily.
"Of sorts?"
She waved away his question as she chewed on her food.
"You needn't worry about me."
"Need I worry about my children?"
She looked up at him with an inscrutable smile.
"Of course not."
"Very well." He looked down at the sandwich that had been placed in front of him and took a healthy bite. Once he'd swallowed, he looked her straight in the eye and said,
"I must apologise for my greeting this morning. I was less than gracious."
She nodded regally.
"And I apologise for arriving unheralded. It was quite ill-bred of me."
He nodded back.
"You, however, apologised for that this morning, while I did not."
She offered him a smile, a genuine one, and he felt his heart lurch. Good God, when she smiled, it transformed her entire face. In all the time he'd been corresponding with her, he'd never dreamed that she would take his breath away.
"Thank you,"
she murmured, her cheeks flushing with the barest hint of pink.
"That was very gracious of you."
Philip cleared his throat and shifted uneasily in his seat. What was wrong with him that he was less comfortable with her smiles than he was with her frowns?
"Right,"
he said, coughing one more time to cover the gruffness in his voice.
"Now that we have that out of the way, perhaps we should address your reason for being here."
Eloise set her sandwich down and regarded him with obvious surprise. Clearly, she hadn't expected him to be so direct.
"You were interested in marriage," she said.
"Are you?"
he countered.
"I'm here," she said simply.
He looked at her assessingly, his eyes searching hers until she squirmed in her seat.
"You are not what I expected, Miss Bridgerton."
"Under the circumstances, I would not think it inappropriate for you to use my given name," she said. "And you are not what I expected either."
He sat back in his seat, looking at her with the vaguest hint of a smile.
"And what did you expect?"
"What did you expect?" Eloise countered.
He gave her a look that told her he'd noticed she'd avoided his question, then said quite bluntly,
"I didn't expect you to be so pretty."
Eloise felt herself lurch back slightly at the unexpected compliment. She hadn't been looking her best that morning, and even if she had, well, she'd never been considered one of the beauties of the ton. Bridgerton women were generally thought to be attractive, vivacious, and personable. She and her sisters were popular, and they'd all received more than one offer of marriage. But men seemed to like them because they liked them, not because they were struck dumb by their beauty. She felt herself flushing, which mortified her, which, of course, caused her cheeks to redden even more.
"Thank you,"
he nodded graciously.
"I am not certain why my appearance would have come as a surprise to you," she said, thoroughly annoyed with herself for reacting so strongly to his flattery.
Heavens, one would think she had never been paid a compliment before. But he was just sitting there, looking at her, looking and staring, and she shivered, and it wasn't the least bit draughty. Could one shiver from feeling too hot? "You yourself wrote that you are a spinster," he said. "There must be some reason you have never married."
"It was not because I received no offers," she felt compelled to inform him.
"Obviously not," he said, tilting his head in her direction as a gesture of compliment. "But I cannot help but be curious as to why a woman like you would feel the need to resort to, well, me."
She looked at him, really looked at him for the first time since she'd arrived. He was quite handsome in a rough, slightly unkempt sort of way. His dark hair looked in dire need of a good trim, and his skin showed signs of a faint tan, which was impressive considering how little sunshine they'd enjoyed lately. He was large and muscular, and sat in his chair with a careless, athletic sort of grace, legs sprawled in a manner that would not have been acceptable in a London drawing-room. And the look on his face told her that he didn't much care that his manners were not de rigueur. It wasn't the same sort of defiant attitude she saw so often among young men of the ton. She'd met so many men of that kind, the ones who made such a point of defying convention, and then spoiled the effect by going out of their way to make sure that everyone knew how daring and scandalous they were. But with Sir Philip it was different. Eloise would have bet good money that it would simply never have occurred to him to care that he wasn't sitting in a properly formal manner, and it certainly wouldn't have occurred to him to make sure that other people knew he didn't care. It made Eloise wonder if that was the mark of a truly self-confident person, and if so, why did he need to resort to her? Because from what she'd seen of him, curt manners this morning aside, he shouldn't have had too much trouble finding himself a wife. "I am here," she said, finally remembering that he had asked her a question, "because after refusing several offers of marriage..."
She knew that a better person would have been more modest and not taken such pains to emphasise the word several, but she just couldn't help herself.
"I find that I still desire a husband. Your letters seem to indicate that you might be a good candidate. It seemed short-sighted not to meet with you, and find out if that was indeed true."
He nodded. "Very practical of you."
"What about you?" she countered. "You were the one who initially brought up the topic of marriage. Why couldn't you simply find yourself a wife among the women here?"
For a moment he did nothing but blink, looking at her as if he couldn't quite believe she hadn't figured it out for herself. Finally he said, "You've met my children." Eloise nearly choked on the bite of sandwich she'd just started to chew.
"I beg your pardon?"
"My children," he said flatly. "You've met them. Twice, I think. You told me so."
"Yes, but what..."
She felt her eyes grow wide.
"Oh, no. Don't tell me they've scared away every prospective wife in the district."
The look he levelled at her was grim. "Most of the women in the area refuse to even enter the ranks of the prospectives." She scoffed.
"They're not that bad."
"They need a mother," he said baldly. She raised her brows.
"Surely you can find a more romantic way to convince me to be your wife."
Philip sighed wearily, running a hand through his already ruffled hair. "Miss Bridgerton," he said, then corrected himself with, "Eloise, I'm going to be honest with you, because, to be frank, I have neither the energy nor the patience for fancy romantic words or cleverly constructed stories. I need a wife. My children need a mother. I invited you here to see if you would be willing to assume such a role, and, indeed, if you and I would suit."
"Which one?"
she whispered. He clenched his hands, his knuckles brushing the tablecloth.
What was it about women? Did they speak in some sort of code?
"Which one? What?" he asked, impatience colouring his voice. "Which one do you want?" she clarified, her voice still soft. "A wife or a mother?" "Both," he said. "I should think that was obvious."
"Which one do you want more?"
Philip stared at her for a long while, aware that this was an important question, quite possibly one that could signal the end of his unusual courtship. Finally, he just offered her a helpless shrug and said, "I'm sorry, but I don't know how to separate the two." She nodded, her eyes serious.
"I see," she murmured. "I expect you were right."
Philip let out a long breath he wasn't even aware he'd been holding. Somehow, God himself only knew how, he'd answered correctly. Or at the very least, not incorrectly. Eloise fidgeted slightly in her seat, then motioned to the half-eaten sandwich on his plate.
"Shall we continue with our meal?" she suggested. "You've been in your greenhouse all morning. I'm sure you must be quite famished."
Philip nodded and took a bite of his food, all of a sudden feeling quite pleased with life. He still wasn't certain that Miss Bridgerton was going to consent to become Lady Crane, but if she did, well, he didn't think he would have any objections. But wooing her wasn't going to be as easy as he'd anticipated. It was clear to him that he needed her more than the other way around. He'd been counting on her being a desperate spinster, which was clearly not the case, despite her advanced years. Miss Bridgerton, he suspected, had a number of options in her life, of which he was only one. But still, something must have compelled her to leave her home and travel all the way out to Gloucestershire. If her life in London was so perfect, why then had she left? But as he watched her across the table, watched her face transform with a mere smile, it occurred to him. He didn't much care why she'd left. He just needed to make sure that she stayed. Chapter 4.
"So sorry to hear that Caroline is colicky and giving you fits. And of course it is too bad that neither Amelia nor Belinda is amenable to her arrival. But you must look upon the bright side, dear Daphne. It would all have been so much more difficult had you birthed twins."
From Eloise Bridgerton to her sister, the Duchess of Hastings, 1 month after the birth of Daphne's third child. Philip whistled to himself as he walked through the main hall toward the staircase, inordinately pleased with his life. He'd spent the better part of the afternoon in the company of Miss Bridgerton. No, Eloise, he reminded himself, and he was now convinced she'd make an excellent wife. She was quite clearly intelligent, and with all those brothers and sisters, not to mention nephews and nieces she'd told him about, surely she'd know how to manage Oliver and Amanda. And, he thought with a wolfish smile, she was rather pretty, and more than once this afternoon he'd caught himself looking at her, wondering how she'd feel in his arms, whether she'd respond to his kiss. His body tightened at the thought. It had been so long since he'd been with a woman, more years than he cared to count. More years, quite honestly, than any man would care to admit to. He'd not availed himself of any of the services offered by the barmaids at the local public inn, preferring his women more freshly washed, and, in truth, not quite so anonymous. Or maybe more anonymous. None of those barmaids were likely to leave the village during their lifetime, and Philip enjoyed his time at the public inn too much to ruin it by constantly having to run into women with whom he'd once lain and no longer cared to. And before Marina's death, well, he'd never even considered being unfaithful to her, despite the fact that they'd not shared a bed since the twins were quite young. She'd been so melancholy following their birth. Marina had always seemed fragile and overly pensive, but it was only after Oliver and Amanda had arrived that she'd sunk into her own world of sorrow and despair. It had been horrifying for Philip, watching the life behind her eyes slip away day by day, until all that was left was an eerie flatness, the barest shadow of the woman who had once existed. He knew that women couldn't have relations immediately following childbirth, but even once she was physically healed, he couldn't have even imagined forcing himself upon her. How was one supposed to lust after a woman who always looked as if she might cry? When the twins were a bit older, and Philip had thought, hoped, really, that Marina was getting better, he had visited her in her bedchamber. Once. She had not refused him, but nor had she taken part in his lovemaking. She'd just lain there, doing nothing, her head turned to the side, her eyes open, barely blinking. It was almost as if she hadn't been there at all. He'd left feeling soiled, morally corrupt, as if he'd somehow violated her, even though she had never uttered the word no, and he had never touched her again. His needs weren't so great that he needed to slake them upon a woman who lay beneath him like a corpse, and he never wanted to feel again as he had that final night. Once he'd returned to his own room, he'd promptly emptied the contents of his stomach, shaking and trembling, disgusted with himself. He had behaved like an animal, desperately trying to rouse in her some sort, any sort of response. When that had proven impossible, he'd grown angry with her, wanted to punish her, and that had terrified him. He'd been too rough. He didn't think he'd hurt her, but he hadn't been gentle, and he never wanted to see that side of himself again. But Marina was gone. Gone. And Eloise was different. She wasn't going to cry at the drop of a hat, or shut herself in her room, picking at her food and crying into her pillow. Eloise had spirit, backbone. Eloise was happy. And if that wasn't a good criterion for a wife, he didn't know what was. He paused at the base of the stairs to check his pocket watch. He had told Eloise that supper would be at 7, and that he would meet her outside her door to take her down to the dining room. He didn't want to be early and appear too eager. On the other hand, it wouldn't do to be late. There was little to be gained in making her think he was disinterested. He snapped his watch shut and rolled his eyes. He was behaving no better than a green boy. This was ridiculous. He was master of his own house and an accomplished scientist. He ought not to be counting minutes just so he could best win a woman's favour. But even as he thought that, he opened his watch for one more check. 3 minutes prior to 7. Excellent. That would give him just enough time to ascend the stairs and meet her outside her door with precisely 1 minute to spare. He grinned, enjoying his warm flush of desire at the thought of her in an evening gown. He hoped it was blue. She would look lovely in blue. His smile deepened. She would look lovely in nothing at all. Except when he found her, upstairs in the hall, outside her bedchamber, her hair had gone white, as, it seemed, had the rest of her. Bloody hell.
Oliver!
He bellowed.
Amanda!
Oh, they're long gone, Eloise bit off. She looked up at him with fuming eyes. Fuming eyes which, he couldn't help but note, were the only part of her not covered with a remarkably thick coating of flour. Well, good for her for closing them in time. He'd always admired quick reflexes in a woman.
Miss Bridgerton,
he said, his hand moving forward to help her, then retracting as he realised there was no helping her. I cannot begin to express...
Don't apologise for them, she snapped.
Right, he said. Of course. But I promise you, I will...
His words trailed off. Truly, the look in her eyes would have been enough to silence Napoleon himself.
Sir Philip, she said, slowly, tightly, looking very much as if she might launch herself at him in a furious frenzy. As you can see, I'm not quite ready for supper.
He took a self-preservational step back.
"I gather the twins paid you a visit," he said.
"Oh, yes," she replied, with no small measure of sarcasm. "And then scampered away. The little cowards themselves are nowhere to be found."
Well, they wouldn't be far, he mused, allowing her the well-deserved insult to his children, while he tried to carry on a conversation as if she didn't look like some sort of hideous ghostly apparition. Somehow it seemed the best course of action, or at the very least, the one least likely to result in her wrapping her fingers around his throat. They'd want to see the results, of course, he said, taking another discreet step back as she coughed, sending up a swirling cloud of flour. I don't suppose you heard any laughter when the flour came down? Cackling, perhaps? She glared at him. Right. He winced. Sorry for that. Stupid joke.
It was difficult, she said,
so tightly he wondered if her jaw might snap,
to hear anything but the sound of the bucket hitting my head.
Damn, he muttered, following her line of sight, until his eyes fell on a large metal bucket lying on its side on the carpet, with a small amount of flour still inside. Are you hurt? She shook her head. He reached out and took her head in his hands, trying to inspect her skin for bumps or bruises.
Sir Philip!
She yelped, attempting to squirm out of his grasp.
I must ask you to...
Be still, he ordered, smoothing his thumbs over her temples, feeling for welts. It was an intimate gesture, and one he found oddly satisfying. She seemed just the right height next to him, and had she been clean, he wasn't sure he'd have been able to stop himself from leaning down and dropping a soft kiss on her brow.
I'm fine,
she practically grunted, wrenching herself free.
The flour weighed more than the bucket.
Philip leaned down and righted the bucket, testing its weight in his hand. It was fairly light and shouldn't have caused too much damage. But still, it wasn't the sort of thing with which one wanted to be struck on the head.
I shall survive, I assure you,
she bit out. He cleared his throat. I imagine you will want a bath. He thought, she said,
I imagine I will want those two little wretches on the end of a rope.
But the words came out under her breath, and just because that was what he would have said, well, it didn't mean she was as uncharitably inclined. I'll have one drawn for you, he said quickly.
Don't bother. The water from my last bath is still in the tub.
He winced. His children's timing couldn't have been more on the spot. Nonetheless, he said hastily, I shall see that it is warmed with a few fresh buckets. He winced again at her glare. Bad choice of words. I'll just see to that now, he said.
Yes, she replied tautly. Do that.
He strode down the hall to give the order to a maid, except that the minute he turned the corner, he saw that a half-dozen servants were already gaping at them, and had in fact set up a betting pool on how long the twins would last before Philip tanned their hides. After sending them on their way, with instructions to draw a new bath immediately, he returned to Eloise's side. He was already dusted with flour, so he saw no harm in taking her hand. I'm terribly sorry, he murmured, now trying not to laugh. His immediate reaction had been fury, but now, well, she did look rather ridiculous. She glared at him, clearly sensing his change of mood. He quickly assumed a sober mien. Perhaps you should return to your room, he suggested.
And sit where? She snapped.
She had a point. She was likely to ruin anything she touched, or at the very least necessitate a thorough cleaning. I'll just keep you company then, he said, trying to sound jovial. She gave him a look that was decidedly unamused. Right, he said, in an attempt to fill the silence with something other than flour. He glanced up over the door, impressed with the twins' handiwork, despite the unfortunate results. I wonder how they did it, he mused. Her mouth fell open.
Does it matter?
Well, he said, seeing from her face that this was not the most advisable avenue of conversation, but continuing nonetheless with, I certainly can't condone their actions, but it was obviously quite cleverly done. I don't see where they attached the bucket and...
They rested it on the top of the door.
I beg your pardon.
I have 7 brothers and sisters, she said dismissively. Do you think I've never seen this prank before? They opened the door just a crack and then carefully placed the bucket.
And you didn't hear them? She glared at him. Right, he said hastily. You were in the bath.
I don't suppose, she said in a haughty voice, that you intend to imply that this was my fault for not having heard them.
Of course not, he said very quickly. Judging from the murderous look in Miss Bridgerton's eyes, he was fairly certain that his health and welfare were directly dependent upon the speed with which he agreed with her. Why don't I leave you to your... Was there really a good way to describe the process of cleaning several pounds of flour off one's person? Will I see you at supper? He asked, deciding that a change of subject was most definitely in order. She nodded, once, briefly. There wasn't a great deal of warmth in that nod, but Philip reckoned he should be happy that she wasn't planning to leave the county that night. I will instruct the cook to keep supper warm, he said, and I will see to punishing the twins.
No,
she said, halting him in his tracks.
Leave them to me.
He turned around slowly, a bit unnerved by the tone of her voice. What precisely do you plan to do with them?
With them or to them?
Philip had never thought the day would come when he'd be frightened by a woman. But as God was his witness, Eloise Bridgerton scared the living wits out of him. The look in her eyes was positively diabolical. Miss Bridgerton, he said, crossing his arms, I must ask, what do you intend to do to my children?
I'm pondering my options.
He considered that. May I depend upon their still being alive tomorrow morning?
Oh, yes, she replied. Alive, and with every limb intact, I assure you.
Philip stared at her for several moments, then let his lips spread into a slow, satisfied smile. He had a feeling that Eloise Bridgerton's vengeance, whatever it might be, would be exactly what his children needed. Surely anyone with 7 brothers and sisters would know how to wreak havoc in the most cunning, underhanded, and ingenious manner. Very well, Miss Bridgerton, he said, almost glad they'd dumped a bucket of flour on her. They are all yours. An hour later, just after he and Eloise sat down for supper, the screaming began. Philip actually dropped his spoon. Amanda's shrieks had a more terrified tenor than usual. Eloise didn't even pause as she placed a spoonful of turtle soup between her lips.
She's fine,
she murmured, delicately wiping her mouth with her serviette. The rapid patter of little feet thundered overhead, signalling that Amanda was racing toward the steps. Philip half rose in his seat. Perhaps I should...
I put a fish in her bed,
Miss Bridgerton said, not quite smiling, but nonetheless looking rather pleased with herself. A fish, he echoed.
Very well. It was a rather big fish.
The tadpole, in his mind, quickly grew into a toothy shark, and he found himself choking on air. He couldn't help but ask, where did you find a fish?
Mrs. Smith, she said,
as if his cook handed out large trout every day of the week. He forced himself to sit back down. He wasn't going to run to save Amanda. He wanted to. He did possess the odd paternal instinct after all, and she was shrieking as if the fires of hell were licking at her toes. But his daughter had made her bed. Now it was time to lie in the one Miss Bridgerton had stunk up for her. He dipped his spoon in his soup, lifted it a few inches, then paused. And what did you place in Oliver's bed?
Nothing.
He quirked a brow in question.
It will keep him in suspense, she explained coolly.
Philip cocked his head toward her in salute. She was good. They'll retaliate, of course.
He felt honour-bound to warn her.
"I'll be ready."
She sounded unconcerned. Then she looked up at him, straight in the eye, momentarily startling him with her direct gaze.
"I suppose they know that you invited me here for the purpose of asking me to be your wife."
"I never said anything to them."
"No," she murmured, "you wouldn't."
He looked over at her sharply, unable to discern if she meant that as an insult.
"I don't feel the need to keep my children apprised of my personal matters."
She shrugged, a delicate little motion that he found infuriating.
"Miss Bridgerton," he said, "I don't need your advice on how to raise my children."
"I didn't say a word on the subject," she returned, "although I might point out that you do appear rather desperate to find them a mother, which would seem to indicate that you do want help."
"Until you agree to take on that role," he bit off, "you may keep your opinions to yourself."
She speared him with a frosty stare, then turned her attention back to her soup. After only two spoonfuls, however, she looked back up at him defiantly and said,
"They need discipline."
"Do you think I don't know that?"
"They also need love."
"They get love," he muttered.
"And attention."
"They get that too."
"From you."
Philip might have been aware that he was far from being a perfect father, but he was damned if he would allow someone else to say so.
"And I suppose you have deduced their state of shameful neglect during the 12 hours since your arrival."
She snorted her disdain.
"It hardly required 12 hours to listen to them this morning, begging you to spend a paltry few minutes in their company."
"They did nothing of the sort," he retorted,
but he could feel the tips of his ears growing hot, as they always did when he was lying. He didn't spend enough time with them, and he was mortified that she'd managed to figure that out in such a short amount of time.
"They practically begged you not to be busy all day," she shot back. "If you spent a bit more time with them..."
"You don't know anything about my children," he hissed. "And you don't know anything about me."
She stood abruptly.
"Clearly,"
she said, heading for the door.
"Wait,"
he called, jumping to his feet.
Damn. How had this happened? Barely an hour ago he'd been convinced that she would become his wife,
and now she was practically on her way back to London. He let out a frustrated breath. Nothing had the ability to turn his temper like his children, or the discussion thereof, or, to be more precise, the discussion of his failings as their father.
"I'm sorry," he said, meaning it too,
or at least meaning it enough not to want her to leave.
"Please."
He held out his hand.
"Don't go."
"I'll not be treated like an imbecile."
"If there is one thing I've learned in the 12 hours since your arrival," he said, purposefully repeating his earlier words, "it's that you're no imbecile."
She regarded him for a few more seconds, then placed her hand in his.
"At the very least," he said, not even caring that he sounded as if he were pleading with her, "you must stay until Amanda arrives."
Her brows rose in question.
"Surely you'll want to savour your victory," he murmured,
then added under his breath,
"I know I would."
She allowed him to reseat her, but they had only one more minute together before Amanda came shrieking into the room, her nursemaid hot on her heels.
"Father!"
Amanda wailed, throwing herself onto his lap. Philip embraced her awkwardly. It was some time since he'd done so, and he'd forgotten how it felt.
"Whatever can be the problem?"
he asked, giving her a pat on the back for good measure. Amanda pulled her face out of its burrowed position in his neck and pointed one furious, shaking finger at Eloise.
"It's her!"
she said, as if referring to the devil himself.
"Miss Bridgerton?" Philip asked.
"She put a fish in my bed!"
"And you dumped flour on her head," he said sternly. "So I'd say you're even."
Amanda's little mouth fell open.
"But you're my father!"
"Indeed."
"You're supposed to take my side.
when you're in the right.
It was a fish,
she sobbed.
So I smell. You'll want a bath, I imagine.
I don't want a bath,
she wailed.
I want you to punish her.
Philip smiled at that. She is rather big for punishing, wouldn't you agree? Amanda stared at him with horrified disbelief. And then, finally, her lower lip shaking, she gasped,
You need to tell her to leave! Right now!
Philip set Amanda down, rather pleased with how the entire encounter was progressing. Maybe it was Miss Bridgerton's calm presence, but he seemed to have more patience than usual. He felt no urge to snap at Amanda, or to avoid the issue altogether by banishing her to her room.
"I beg your pardon, Amanda," he said, "but Miss Bridgerton is my guest, not yours, and she will remain here as long as I wish."
Eloise cleared her throat, loudly.
"Or," Philip amended, "as long as she wishes to remain."
Amanda's entire face scrunched in thought.
"Which doesn't mean," he said quickly, "that you may torture her in an attempt to force her away."
"But..."
"No buts."
"But..."
"What did I just say?"
"But she's mean."
"I think she's very clever," Philip said, "and I wish I'd put a fish in your bed months ago."
Amanda stepped back in horror. "Go to your room, Amanda."
"But it smells bad."
"You have only yourself to blame."
"But my bed..."
"You'll have to sleep on the floor," he replied.
Face quivering, entire body quivering, truth be told, she dragged herself toward the door.
But...
"Yes, Amanda,"
he asked, in what he thought to be an impressively patient voice.
"But she didn't punish Oliver,"
the little girl whispered.
"That wasn't very fair of her. The flower was his idea."
Philip raised his brows.
"Well, it wasn't only my idea,"
Amanda insisted.
"We thought it up together."
Philip actually chuckled.
"I wouldn't worry about Oliver if I were you, Amanda.
Or rather," he said, giving his chin a thoughtful stroke with his fingers,
"I would worry. I suspect Miss Bridgerton has plans for him yet."
That seemed to satisfy Amanda, and she mumbled a barely articulate,
"Good night, Father,"
before allowing her nursemaid to lead her from the room. Philip turned back to his soup, feeling very pleased with himself. He couldn't remember the last time he'd emerged from a run-in with one of the twins, in which he'd felt he'd handled everything just right. He took a sip, then, still holding his spoon, looked over at Eloise and said,
"Poor Oliver will be quaking in his boots."
She appeared to be trying hard not to grin. "He won't be able to sleep." Philip shook his head.
"Not a wink, I should think. And you should watch your step. I'd wager he'll set some sort of trap at his door."
"Oh, I have no plans to torture Oliver this evening," she said, with a blithe wave of her hand. "That would be far too easy to predict. I prefer the element of surprise."
"Yes," he said with a chuckle. "I can see that you would."
Eloise answered him with a smug expression. "I would almost consider leaving him in perpetual agony, except that it really wouldn't be fair to Amanda." Philip shuddered.
"I hate fish."
"I know. You wrote me as much."
"I did,"
she nodded. "Odd that Mrs. Smith even had any in the house, but I suppose the servants like it."
They descended into silence, but it was a comfortable, companionable sort of quietude.
And as they ate, moving through the courses of the supper, as they chatted about nothing in particular, it occurred to Philip that perhaps marriage wasn't supposed to be so hard. With Marina, he'd always felt like he was tiptoeing around the house, always fearful that she was going to descend into one of her bouts with melancholia, always disappointed when she seemed to withdraw from life, and, indeed, almost disappear. But maybe marriage was supposed to be easier than that. Maybe it was supposed to be like this. companionable, comfortable. He couldn't remember the last time he had spoken with anyone about his children, or the raising thereof. His burdens had always been his alone, even when Marina had been alive. Marina herself had been a burden, and he was still wrestling with the guilt he felt at his relief that she was gone. But Eloise... He looked across the table at the woman who had so unexpectedly fallen into his life. Her hair glowed almost red in the flickering candlelight, and her eyes, when she caught him staring at her, sparkled with vitality and just a hint of mischief. She was, he was coming to realize, exactly what he needed. Smart, opinionated, bossy. They weren't the sort of things men usually looked for in a wife, but Philip so desperately needed someone to come to Romney Hall and fix things. Nothing was quite right, from the house to his children, to the slightly hushed pall that had hung over the place when Marina had been alive, and sadly had not lifted even after her death. Philip would gladly cede some of his husbandly power to a wife if she would only make everything right again. He'd be more than happy to disappear into his greenhouse and let her be in charge of everything else. Would Eloise Bridgerton be willing to take on such a role? Dear God, he hoped so. Chapter 5.
Implore you, Mother, you must punish Daphne. It is not fair that I am the only one sent to bed without pudding. And for a week. A week is far too long, especially since it was all, mostly, Daphne's idea.
From Eloise Bridgerton to her mother, left upon Violet Bridgerton's night table during Eloise's 10th year. It was strange, Eloise thought, how much could change in a single day. Because now, as Sir Philip was escorting her through his home, ostensibly viewing the portrait gallery, but really just prolonging their time together, she was thinking, he might make a perfectly fine husband after all. Not the most poetic way to phrase a concept that ought to have been full of romance and passion, but theirs wasn't a typical courtship. And with only 2 years remaining until her 30th birthday, Eloise couldn't really afford to be fanciful. But still, there was something. In the candlelight, Sir Philip was somehow more handsome, perhaps even a little dangerous-looking. The rugged planes of his face seemed to angle and shadow in the flickering light, lending him a more sculptured look, almost like the statues she'd visited at the British Museum. And as he stood next to her, his large hand possessively at her elbow, his entire presence seemed to envelop her. It was odd and thrilling. And just a little bit terrifying, but gratifying too. She'd done a crazy thing, running off in the middle of the night, hoping to find happiness with a man she'd never met. It was a relief to think that maybe it hadn't all been a complete mistake, that maybe she'd gambled with her future and won. Nothing would have been worse than slinking back to London, admitting failure and having to explain to her entire family what she'd done. She didn't want to have to admit that she'd been wrong, to herself or anyone else, but mostly to herself. Sir Philip had proven to be an enjoyable supper companion, even if he wasn't quite so glib or conversational as she was used to. But he obviously possessed a sense of fair play, which Eloise deemed essential in any spouse. He had accepted, even admired, her fish-in-the-bed technique with Amanda. Many of the men Eloise had met in London would have been horrified that a gently bred lady would even think of resorting to such underhanded tactics. And maybe, just maybe, this would work. Marriage to Sir Philip did seem a harebrained scheme when she allowed herself to think about it in a logical manner, but it wasn't as if he were a complete stranger. They had been corresponding for over a year, after all. "My grandfather," Philip said mildly, gesturing to a large portrait. "He was quite handsome," Eloise said, even though she could barely see him in the dim light. She motioned to the picture to the right.
"Is that your father?"
Philip nodded once, curtly, the corners of his lips tightening.
"And where are you?"
she asked, sensing that he didn't wish to talk about his father.
"Over here, I'm afraid."
Eloise followed his direction to a portrait of Philip as a young boy, of perhaps 12 years, posing with someone who could only have been his brother. His older brother.
"What happened to him?"
she asked, since he had to be dead. If he lived, Philip could not have inherited his house or baronetcy.
"Waterloo,"
he answered succinctly. Impulsively, she placed her hand over his.
"I'm sorry."
For a moment, she didn't think he was going to say anything. But eventually, he let out a quiet,
"No one was sorrier than I."
"What was his name?"
"George."
"You must have been quite young,"
she said, counting back to 1815 and doing the math in her head.
21. My father died 2 weeks following.
She thought about that. At 21, she was supposed to have been married. All young ladies of her station were expected to have been married by then. One would think that would confer a measure of adulthood. But now 21 seemed impossibly young and green, and far too innocent to have inherited a burden one had never thought to receive.
"Marina was his fiancée,"
he said. Her breath rushed over her lips, and she turned to him, her hand falling away from his.
"I didn't know," she said.
He shrugged.
"It doesn't matter. Here, would you like to see her portrait?"
"Yes,"
Eloise replied, discovering that she did indeed wish to see Marina. They had been cousins, but distant ones, and it had been years since they'd visited with one another. Eloise remembered dark hair and light eyes. Blue, maybe, but that was all. She and Marina had been of an age, and so they had been thrust together at family gatherings. But Eloise didn't recall their ever having very much in common. Even when they were barely older than Amanda and Oliver, their differences had been clear. Eloise had been a boisterous child, climbing trees and sliding down banisters, always following her older siblings, begging them to allow her to take part in whatever they were doing. Marina had been quieter, almost contemplative. Eloise remembered tugging on her hand, trying to get her to come outside and play. But Marina had just wanted to sit with a book. Eloise had taken note of the pages, however, and she was quite convinced that Marina never moved beyond page 32. It was a strange thing to remember, she supposed, except that her 9-year-old self had found it so astounding. Why would someone choose to stay inside with a book when the sun was shining, and then not even read it? She'd spent the rest of the visit whispering with her sister Francesca, trying to figure out just what it was that Marina was doing with that book.
"Do you remember her?" Philip asked.
"Just a little,"
Eloise replied, not sure why she didn't wish to share her memory with him. And anyway, it was the truth. That was the sum of her recollections of Marina. That 1 week in April over 20 years earlier, whispering with Francesca as Marina stared at a book. Eloise allowed Philip to lead her over to Marina's portrait. She had been painted seated on some sort of ottoman, with her dark red skirts artfully arranged about her. A younger version of Amanda was on her lap, and Oliver stood at her side, in one of those poses young boys were always forced to assume, serious and stern, as if they were miniature adults.
"She was lovely," Eloise said.
Philip just stared at the image of his dead wife, then, almost as if it required a force of will, turned his head and walked away.
Had he loved her?
Did he love her still? Marina should have been his brother's bride. Everything seemed to suggest that Philip had been given her by default. But that didn't mean he didn't love her. Maybe he had been secretly in love with her while she had been engaged to his brother. Or maybe he had fallen in love after the wedding. Eloise stole a look at his profile as he stared sightlessly at a painting on the wall. There had been emotion on his face when he had looked at Marina's portrait. She wasn't sure what he had felt for her, but it was definitely still something. It had only been a year, she reminded herself. A year might make up the official period of mourning, but it wasn't very long to get past the death of a loved one. Then he turned. His eyes hit hers, and she realized she'd been staring at him, mesmerized by the planes of his face. Her lips parted with surprise, and she wanted to look away, felt as if she ought to blush and stammer at having been caught. But somehow she could not. She just stood there, transfixed, breathless, as a strange heat spread across her skin. He was 10 feet away, at the very least, and it felt as if they were touching. "Eloise," he whispered, or at least she thought he did. She saw his lips form the word more than she actually heard his voice. And then, somehow, the moment was broken. Maybe it was his whisper, maybe the creak of a wind-blown tree outside. But Eloise was finally able to move, to think, and she quickly turned back to Marina's portrait, firmly affixing her gaze on her late cousin's serene face. "The children must miss her," Eloise said, needing to say something, anything that would restart the conversation and restore her composure. For a moment, Philip said nothing. And then, finally, "Yes, they've missed her for a long time." It seemed to Eloise a rather odd way to phrase it.
"I know how they feel," she said. "I was quite young when my father died."
He looked over at her.
"I didn't realize."
She shrugged.
"It's not something I talk about a great deal. It was a long time ago."
He crossed back to her side, his steps slow and methodical.
"Did it take you very long to get over it?"
"I'm not certain it's something you ever do get over," she said. "Completely, that is. But no, I don't think about him every day, if that's what you want to know."
She turned away from Marina's portrait. She'd been focusing on it for too long and was beginning to feel oddly intrusive.
"I think it was more difficult for my older brothers," she said. "Anthony, he is the eldest, and was already a young man when it happened, had a particularly difficult time with it. They were very close. And my mother, of course."
She looked over at him.
"My parents loved each other very much."
"How did she react to his passing?"
"Well, she cried a great deal at first," Eloise said. "I'm sure we weren't meant to know. She always did it in her room at night, after she thought we were all asleep. But she missed him dreadfully, and it couldn't have been easy with 7 children.
"I thought there were 8 of you.
Hyacinth was not yet born. I believe my mother was 8 months along."
"Good God,"
she thought she heard him murmur. Good God was right. Eloise had no idea how her mother had managed.
"It was unexpected," she told him. "He was stung by a bee." A bee. Can you imagine that? He was stung by a bee and then... Well, I don't need to bore you with the details. "Here," she said briskly, "let us leave. It's too dark in here to see the portraits properly anyway."
It was a lie, of course. It was too dark. But Eloise couldn't have cared less about that. Talking about her father's death always made her feel a bit strange, and she just didn't feel like standing there surrounded by paintings of dead people.
"I should like to see your greenhouse," she said.
Now, put that way, it did seem an odd request.
"Tomorrow, then," she said, "when it's light."
His lips curved into a hint of a smile.
"We can go now."
"But we won't be able to see anything."
"We won't be able to see everything," he corrected. "But the moon is out, and we'll take a lantern."
She glanced doubtfully out the window. "It's cold."
"You can take a coat."
He leaned down with a gleam in his eye.
"You're not afraid, are you?"
"Of course not,"
she retorted, knowing he was baiting her, but falling for it anyway. He quirked a brow.